in Oakland. NBA playoffs, the Celtics beat the Bucks in overtime, 113-107. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service on this Monday, April 16th. Cloudy and windy, more light snow off and on throughout the day, some minor accumulation, a high of 37. Tonight then, cloudy and windy, a low of 27. We'll see winds up to 30 miles per hour overnight. And then tomorrow, Tuesday, partly sunny and 39. Here are the numbers right now. Wind from the west-northwest at 17. It's a gray sky overhead, 27 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha, 28 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Coming up on 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. Newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Information at jackandrea.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg. Glad to be sitting opposite Dr. Jerry Mast, who is Associate Professor of Political Science at Carthage College, a frequent guest to the Morning Show, and here to talk about all kinds of intriguing turns of event that are in the air, including most dramatically, I guess, as of last week, the announcement by Speaker of the House Paul Ryan that he is not going to be seeking re-election this fall. But of course, since the invitation to Professor Mast was issued, we have also had the explosive release of at least excerpts from the new book by James Comey and an initial interview that in which he speaks out quite decisively against President Trump. So we probably should at least touch on that as well. First of all, Professor Mast, we welcome you back to the Morning Show.
Thanks, Greg. It's always good to be here.
Glad to have you here. Thanks for making time for this. Let's begin where we were originally going to begin, which is probably still a good place to begin, namely to take in the announcement from Speaker Paul Ryan that he was not going to seek re-election, and so in effect stepping down from the speakership once this current term expires, of course. And at least according to what he's saying right now, evidently his political career has come to an end. He seems to have no plans for running for future office. This is not a ploy to set himself up for a future run at the president. Again, and that's what he's saying at the moment. First of all, how surprised were you by Speaker Ryan's announcement?
Well, it's an interesting situation, I guess. I've heard someone else put it, unexpected but not shocked. I think that kind of sums it up. I think close observation of Mr. Ryan and Washington, D.C. indicated that he was not particularly, you know, happy. This was not the most fulfilling position for him. He was reluctant to take the position in the first place. And the nature of Washington, D.C. these days is enormously unpleasant. Being Speaker of the House puts you in a very challenging position. I think that the road was always going to be rocky. So I think that he has encountered the difficulties that he has really shouldn't be a particular surprise. He always seemed to give the impression that he viewed this job, one, with some reluctance, but also as a kind of temporary position. So, you know, it's not terribly surprising. And then when you take that into account with the tensions that have existed between Mr. Ryan and the White House, Mr. Trump, and the real kind of personal tensions between the two men, the particular direction that the Republican Party has taken in a direction, I think, not to Mr. Ryan's liking. Add all that up together, and yeah, it's not surprising that he decided that, you know, this was enough for him. On another level, though, it's hard to identify many Republicans outside the president himself who exemplify the Republican Party, right? Mr. Ryan's star burned bright, and it burned for quite a while. But given his relative youth, I think that many people expected it to burn longer. And so, if in fact he means what he says, and this really is the moment in which he exits stage right, so to speak, I think that people will kind of look at his career as one of you know, surprising potential significant accomplishment in political terms for an individual, and yet, given all of that, kind of disappointing that he didn't go farther. Now, that said, you know, maybe he's not really done.
One of my memories of Speaker Ryan is, of course, the last time he was on the campaign trail when he was at certain campaign stops the target of catcalls from certain members of his audiences who saw him as far too moderate, far too swung to the left. And I should think that had to be really disconcerting for Paul Ryan to find himself suddenly not coasting to victory in quite the same way. Not that numerically, ultimately, he faced any sort of trouble, but he was, it just felt like he was operating in a very different landscape.
Right. I wouldn't say that Mr. Ryan was too moderate, nor would I say that the criticism that was levied against him was because he was moderate, at least not in the kind of conventional left-right spectrum sense. But, I mean, I completely agree with the general tenor of your question, and that is that Mr. Ryan became the target of all kinds of criticism not just from the other side of the aisle, mind you, but from within his own party. And this, I think, indicates the real tensions that exist within the party right now. It's also the case that there is tensions within the Democratic Party, but the Republican Party is where the real show is unfolding as far as internal tensions go. And rather than, you know, I guess here's how I would characterize the kind of the factions that have emerged in the party. You have a kind of an establishment wing of the Republican Party, which I wouldn't necessarily call moderate, although if you're a moderate in the Republican Party, that's probably where you're going to be.
Right. And that might be how you're viewed by certain people,
right,
even if that's not really what you're.
Correct, correct, correct. And then you have this populist wing, and that populist wing wasn't created necessarily by Mr. Trump. I would say that the populist wing really kind of arrived on the stage in 2010 with the rise of the Tea Party. And in some ways, the Tea Party, the populist wing, as I'm referring to it, is more and less conservative than the establishment overall. So the Tea Party wing, the populist wing, I think for the most part really doesn't have or share the kind of fervor for anti-government program slashing, entitlement reform, and so forth that certain key members of the establishment like Mr. Ryan hold, right? The idea of cutting taxes on the wealthy, deregulating businesses, that's become the kind of the establishment agenda. And in the last quarter century, right, this has become even more so. So I would say the establishment wing, right, once upon a time, in much of the middle of the 20th century, was for the most part a moderate kind of place to be. But since the 1980s, it increasingly shifted to the right. And I think Mr. Ryan's legacy is to be a part of that, to turn the establishment of the Republican Party into a very conservative, economically conservative place to be, a very kind of anti-government organization. And that stands in contrast to the populist wing, right? The populist wing is not that fired up about slashing, you know, Social Security, privatizing Medicare, and so forth. And this is where I think Mr. Trump was able to, during the campaign in 2016, really kind of fire up people who felt that the establishment, and by people I'm saying, you know, many blue-collar white voters, felt that the Republican establishment agenda doesn't really necessarily fit with them. On the other hand, the populist wing is more conservative than the establishment on cultural issues, on social issues, and so for things like immigration, law and order issues, affirmative action, race relations, very much more conservative than the establishment. And so when we talk about criticism of Mr. Ryan coming from his party, I think it's coming from that populist wing that saw Mr. Ryan looking at then-candidate Trump as kind of an anathema to many of the things that he feels the Republican Party should be about. Small government, deregulation, low taxes on the rich, but tolerant and open to all comers on a more social level.
So that really put him in an uncomfortable position in a lot of respects. It's just hard to imagine being able to easily navigate that. How would you characterize Speaker Ryan's speakership, if that's a word, dating back to when he first took the position to where he is right now and the kind of Speaker of the House that he is right now? How drastic a difference has there been in the way that he has functioned and the kind of challenges with which he has had to contend?
Yeah, that's a good question. So when political scientists look at speakers, they look at a couple different things to try to get a sense of how we should view a particular speaker. And speakers speakers have to operate in environments that are different from one another. Environments change. And as the environment changes, that creates both challenges and opportunities. And so for particular kinds of leadership. So an example, when the majority party is largely united, there's a lot of kind of internal homogeneity. The party agrees with itself, more or less, on key kinds of issues. Well, then there creates an opportunity for speakers to kind of convince their membership to empower them with lots of formal authority in order to facilitate passage of the policy agenda for which there's not a lot of controversy within the majority party. So that's one kind of mode of speakership leadership. The alternative would be wherein the party is not particularly united, that there's a lot of heterogeneity within the majority party. And in that kind of situation, there's more likely to be overlap between the majority party and the minority party, and no real kind of obvious consensus on big kinds of policy questions. In that kind of situation, the membership is much less likely to empower the speaker with formal authority because there's no agreement on what should we be doing. And when that happens, kind of formal authority migrates outward to the committees, the committee chairs. And there's still the chance for speakers to be influential in that regard and successful. The most famous example of this that I can think of is Sam Rayburn. Speaker of the House in the middle of the 20th century, the 50s and 60s. When we look at Mr. Ryan, I guess there's a couple, it's interesting because when the majority party tends to be very united, it's united because there's real differences between it and the minority party. We have political polarization going on. When the majority party is not united, there tends to be less polarization, right, going on. And then you end up with kind of centrist types of policies. But in the current mode, we have polarization, right, which should unite the majority party, and yet the majority party has these big kind of rifts in it. And so when Speaker Boehner, John Boehner, Republican from Ohio, was kind of driven out, he stepped down, but he faced a challenge. To his leadership in 2015, that was just an example of the kind of the Tea Party populist faction within the party no longer willing to kind of tolerate the approach of the establishment wing, and you know, as a result, there was this kind of vacuum, and there was really nobody of national stature, I think, capable of stepping into that situation. And trying to move the House forward, other than Paul Ryan, I think he was the obvious choice. Now that said, I think his speakership is not characterized by significant policy accomplishments. For the most part, I think of the Congress these days as, to use Norman Ornstein's term, the broken branch. It's not particularly functional, and Mr. Ryan has not been able to fix that. So, you know, it's not a great track record of accomplishment. That said, the circumstances were kind of stacked against him from the get-go.
So it's hard to imagine any speaker accomplishing maybe significantly more than
correct.
Speaker Ryan did.
The problems in Washington have much less to do with Mr. Ryan than they do with the kind of larger environmental factors that explain the dysfunction in terms of enmity, animosity, special interest, dominance of the system, and so forth.
Right. And of course, you also speak of not just the big rift between the two parties and between left and right, but also even within
the Republican Party.
Right. And to a lesser extent, within the Democrats as well. Something else that's worth talking about is that Speaker Ryan's decision not to seek re-election comes on the heels of similar decisions being made by a number of other Republicans as well, and a small handful of Democrats. But it seems as though the ledger line is very different on the Republican side of things. First of all, what is this? How should we read this? This is an indication of what? And what does it mean in terms of the overall health of the Republican Party and their prospects for November?
Right. You're right. The number of Republican retirements in Congress right now is twice the average number of retirements for midterm elections going back, I think it's six election cycles. Right now, 41, I believe, if my number's right. Republicans have announced their retirement. Now, some of those are retiring in order to run for higher office, so House members seeking a Senate seat or a member of Congress seeking a governorship. And in that kind of situation, you can just say, well, I mean, that's a kind of a normal functional retirement for purposes of climbing the ladder. But most of those retirements reflect something else. Political scientists tend to look at this concept, they call it strategic exit. That is to say, when national conditions turn against your party, we can expect a couple of things to happen. One, the turnout differentials won't work in your favor. That is to say, you're unlikely to have the kind of turnout on your side of the aisle that you would like, whereas your opponents are likely to have higher than normal turnout on their side of the aisle. Swing voters, to the extent that there's still some out there, will swing not in your favor. And not unrelated to all of that, you also get what we in political science we call strategic entrance. You get high-quality challengers come out of the woodwork in situations where the national environment does not work in the majority party's favor. Right? And so in those kinds of situations, many members of the majority party decide, you know what, I'm going to retire instead of facing this difficult re-election. and so when I'm watching all of these Republicans announce their retirement, those are the kinds of things that the political science literature suggests are relevant to use as a form of analysis. In the case of Mr. Ryan, his decision to step down doesn't so much reflect a calculation on his part that he isn't going to win should he decide to run in November. I think that the race would have been closer than it has been in a number of years, but I still don't see reason to think that he wouldn't have been able to hold on to his seat. His approval numbers nationally, not very good, but in the state of Wisconsin, they're pretty solid. And just the history of his victories in this district are enough to, you know, not count him out at the risk of understatement. But I do think that Mr. Ryan's retirement decision to retire could very well reflect an expectation on his part that his party's going to lose the majority. Mm-hmm. And if his party loses the majority, right, I mean, there's no fun. It's no fun being a member of the minority in the House of Representatives. If you're going to be in the minority party, make it the Senate, where you have more influence over the process, and you can force the majority party to bargain with you. But not so in the House. And so, you know, when you take into account the kind of the would have to be serious frustrations personally, dealing with the internal tensions in the majority party, with the prospect of being relegated to the minority, then, I would say that nobody should be shocked by his decision.
Mm. What is the what is sort of the framework within which we should be thinking about November? You can certainly find plenty of people who are predicting a blue swamping over the red come November. In other words, things are just going to dramatically, decisively sweep Democratic in November. And then other more cautious observers are really saying, wait, just because the total numbers look that way does not mean that individual races are going to play out that way, that there are still ways in which plenty of Republicans are very likely to hold on to their seats. How do you think, what is the wisest way for us to be thinking about November?
Well, it's certainly the case that plenty of Republicans will be holding on to their seats. So when we're talking about a big changing election, right, we're talking a seat shift, you know, of 30 or 40 or 50 seats, right? I mean, that would be a big shift from one party to the other. And the Democrats don't need that many seats to switch over. It's like 20-some seats is what they need to swing their way. So there's that. I would say that we're still half a year away from the election, and a lot of things can happen. A fair assessment of what we've seen so far in terms of races and special elections and so forth all seem to indicate that the Democrats are going to have a very good year. Most recently, the 18th congressional district in Pennsylvania is a case in point. Many people have been looking at that and talking about it. And that's a district in which President Trump carried the district in 2016 19 or 20 percentage points, and the Democratic candidate won the election very, very narrowly, very, very small margin. But nonetheless, you know, a near 20 percentage point swing from voting Republican for President Trump on the one hand to replacing the Republican who steps down with a Democrat.
Right. And we should mention that President Trump stumped for him, went to Pennsylvania to campaign on his behalf very vigorously.
Correct. The other really kind of bright shining light that stands out amongst the data that would give us some indication to this point is the Senate race in Alabama, in which Doug Jones, Democratic candidate, defeated former state Supreme Court Justice Roy Moore. And there are kind of idiosyncratic elements to that race that, you know, should caution us from drawing too many conclusions about it in a general sense. But nonetheless, whenever a Democrat wins a statewide race in Alabama, that should capture your attention and indicate something about the kind of the swing in national sentiment or a tide, so to speak. So those kinds of things suggest that the Democrats are going to have a very good year. The generic ballot that various polling organizations ask Americans about who they would like to see in control of Congress all kind of suggests that Democrats are headed for a good year. Things could change, right? Things could change between now and then. But that said, it's kind of hard to envision the Republicans, given the situation that they're in right now, reversing that. It's possible. It's possible. But there's a lot of momentum that they would have to change at this point. So that said, I think the House is definitely in play for the Democrats. I think the Republicans would be are facing a real challenge to hold on to it. The Senate, different story. There are far more vulnerable seats on the Democratic side this year than there are on the Republican side. Just as a kind of a happenstance, it's kind of the random luck of the draw in terms of which seats come up every 2 years. A third of the seats in the Senate happen to be up. So Republicans should be focusing more on the Senate, I would think, in terms of holding out hope that they're going to hold on to at least part of Congress.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Jerry Mast, who is Associate Professor of Political Science at Carthage College. We have been talking just now about prospects for November for the Republican Party, chiefly as we talk about Speaker Paul Ryan's decision to not seek re-election this fall, and at least for the time being, apparently ready to end his political life, at least in elected office, at least for the time being. Professor Mast, you've already touched on the fact that although we have been focusing on the really divisive state of affairs within the Republican Party, that things are not perfectly unified within the Democratic Party, and probably a lot of people would argue that historically the Democratic Party tends not to be quite as cohesively unified as the Republicans have sometimes been. How would you characterize whatever unrest is within the Democratic Party at this point, and maybe in particular some of the interesting challenges they face in terms of sort of sorting out their identity and who their headline leadership should be?
Right. Well, midterm elections tend to be, to a notable extent, some kind of referendum on the sitting president, right? And the historical pattern is that swings against the party that holds the White House in the first midterm. So Democrats have that going for them because Mr. Trump's numbers are solid within the Republican Party, but very poor outside of it. And so that will mean that their turnout game will be easier to play, and they'll perform well in the middle with independents and swing voters. But the challenges that they face, I think, beyond November have to do with kind of figuring out a path forward between, you know, what I think is like on the Republican side, a conflict that can be characterized between a kind of populism on the one hand and the establishment on the other. And the Democratic Party has become much more liberal on a variety of social issues. But the establishment has been more kind of centrist, right? So since the 1980s, the creation of the Democratic Leadership Council, the New Democrats was the term that applied to a number of these people. One of the key architects of that was Bill Clinton, all kind of responding to the emergence of the conservative movement, the election, and then re-election of Ronald Reagan, and then the election of George Herbert Walker Bush, saying to themselves and to the party that the Democratic Party has to be more pragmatic, has to move to the center on a number of economic issues, try to partner with businesses and so forth, which worked quite well for the party in 1992 and again in 1996. But that identity for the party as a kind of a centrist economic party, at least at the top, kind of gradually became increasingly unpopular with the recession of 2007, 2008, the Occupy Wall Street movement, all kind of injected this increasingly liberal economic view of where the party should go. And so if you look at you know, who captures the most buzz in Washington is for the Democrats. You got to look at Bernie Sanders. You got to look at Liz Warren. These are our economic populists, progressives on the left, and those who are more comfortable in the center as far as economic issues are concerned. Somebody like, say, Chuck Schumer, have had to kind of tone down their positions and accommodate Mr. Sanders and Ms. Warren and so forth. And so I think that the Democratic Party has shifted in that direction. You could say that Bernie Sanders lost the nomination in 2016, but he wound up, I think, kind of winning the poll position, if you will, over kind of determining where the parties are supposed to head in response to having lost the election. That said, there will be people who argue in the other direction, right? That, look, if what we really want to do is take back the Senate, take back the White House, that you're going to have to kind of recommit to a center kind of position in order to compete with swing voters. That debate will have to be fought within the Democratic Party as we get closer to thinking about who's going to compete for the nomination in 2020. I don't think it's going to be a big issue this fall for the midterms.
It's once we get past that.
Yeah.
Wow. Interesting. That's something we'll want to revisit, and I'll be anxious to even hear your thoughts. Were you in a position to guide them one direction or the other in terms of what you think is the wiser course of action? But we'll save that for another time. Of course, plenty of other headlines have been generated as of late, and probably the biggest headlines at the moment concern this blockbuster new book by Mr. Comey, and the interview that he did with George Stephanopoulos for ABC, in which he really lays down the gauntlet in no uncertain terms, and as far as how he sees Donald Trump as president. First of all, from what you have seen and read thus far, were you at all taken aback by what he had to say, or how he said it, or was it entirely expected?
Catch the interview, so I didn't see it in person. I have heard characterizations of it, so I have to reserve some kind of specific judgment until said time that I can see what he had to say. But I guess I'm not surprised. And I am. Again, this is kind of a strange position of should we be view something as unexpected but not shocking. That's kind of how I guess I see it. This is in some sense expected and still shocking, so it's maybe the flip side of that. I think it's important to keep in mind how abnormal all of this is. So we're now approaching the midpoint of the Trump administration. On one level, it's easy to kind of become used to this kind of news, right? It's just another, tweet from the president, right? Criticizing his critics, kind of questioning key institutions and so forth. Making claims based on kind of dubious evidence. And so I think all of us tend to feel like, we're getting used to it. But it isn't normal. This is really unusual in a historical sense. Mr. Trump is not a normal president by any stretch of the imagination. And in a time of great partisan polarization, which I think we're in, there is a real tendency for people to want to think that what it is that is going on is in fact acceptable, is in fact normal, when perhaps it's not. And I don't want mean to kind of keep going back to Mr. Ryan, but there's been a lot of thinking and talking and writing about Mr. Ryan in the last 4 days or so, and the conservative columnist Brett Stevens, former writer for the Wall Street Journal, a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, now writing for the New York Times, wrote an article really critical of Mr. Ryan, not on a policy basis, because Mr. Stevens agrees more or less with most of Mr. Ryan's policy vision, but rather criticizing him for not speaking out against Mr. Trump in a more forceful way, for not standing up for what Mr. Stevens argues is what we could call decency or civility, for kind of decorum, for a commitment to the rule of law and faith in the key public institutions of the country. And I think that for many kind of conservative intellectual critics of the president, that argument resonates. And I think that there are a handful of public figures in the Republican Party who you could say lived up to what Mr. Stevens is talking about, right? Jeffrey Flake, senator from Arizona, famously or infamously, depending upon your perspective on the president, spoke out in very harshly critical terms on the Senate floor against the president. Bob Corker, in an interview with several interviews with the New York Times, levied some really serious criticism of the president of his own party. John McCain, the other senator from Arizona, also has had some very critical things to say about the president, both in government but also in speeches abroad. And so you look at those figures, right? I mean, I think that it would be not unusual to kind of think that in personal terms, it wouldn't be hard to see Mr. Ryan kind of joining that group of people in terms of kind of people who would like to see the Republican Party stand up for principles and values in a tolerant and open kind of way, positively building a case for their ideas. Many people over the weekend have kind of identified Mr. Ryan with one of his mentors from the 90s, Jack Kemp, member of the Congress from New York, and then Secretary of Housing and Urban Development in the first Bush administration, as this kind of very economically conservative but positive kind of person and tolerant and in favor of civil rights and affirmative action and so forth, reaching out, trying to grow the tent. That just kind of feels like what Mr. Flake has stood for in his speeches, what people wanted Mr. Ryan to stand for, but couldn't. The other really, I thought, interesting kind of take on Mr. Ryan was offered by Ross Douthat, another conservative columnist who writes for the New York Times. And Mr. Douthat wrote that it's wrong to kind of view Mr. Ryan as this champion on the one hand or villain on the other. What he really has been is this, you know, kind of committed and reasonably successful party man, kind of committed to the party. And I think that there's something to that. I mean, I think that his argument works on a number of levels. And to kind of support it, he shows how Mr. Ryan, you know, was willing to vote for Medicare Part D during the first Bush term in the early 2000s. He was willing to vote for No Child Left Behind. These are programs that kind of expand the federal role. Why, given his kind of small government perspective? Well, because he's a pragmatic party man. And then when you see him take on the speakership, right, he's trying to cut some deals and so forth. He decides at some point to try to work with a president whose campaign he resisted and very noticeably didn't support in kind of vocal terms. Again, that's kind of a pragmatic move by a man committed to the party. I agree with that to a point, although where I think Mr. Douthat's analysis breaks down is that the Republican Party really has kind of the establishment of it. The establishment has moved in a very kind of non-pragmatic direction into a very, very kind of conservative space in which there hasn't been a whole lot of compromise, at least in ideological terms. And so Mr. Ryan is part of this kind of contention going on right now over the proper role of the party. And it has to, it kind of looks like Mr. Trump has won that kind of contest. With Mr. Ryan stepping down, with Mr. Flake stepping down, the populist vision for the Republican Party seems to have taken root. The question is, of course, is that a sustainable direction for the party to take? The midterms will give us some indication of that, as will the presidential election in 2020.
Hmm. With maybe 4 or 5 minutes to go, I should not open up this can of worms, but I can't avoid it with you sitting here. With headlines sort of mounting around the president himself as the Mueller investigation goes forward and other kind of blockbuster developments, including the FBI raid of his personal lawyer's offices and so on. What kind of peril is President Trump in at the moment? Is it even possible for us to really know or really solidly calculate?
Well, I mean, it's impossible for us to know with certainty, but there's been so much attention paid to the issue. If you follow it closely, I think you can't avoid the conclusion that he is quite likely in a great deal of political peril. The prospect of obstruction of justice seems, at this point, pretty clear, and questions surrounding conspiracy to commit computer fraud, wire fraud, campaign via election, campaign finance regulation violations, all of those things are distinct possibilities. Now, what comes of that? That I think, you know, there's a good deal of more uncertainty. Will the case, once it's kind of been made, be enough to significantly damage Mr. Trump's standing within his own party? I don't know. That remains to be seen. Will it damage him outside the party? Well, I think for sure. It's worth noting that amongst Democrats, there's not a whole lot more damage that can be done. But there are still people in the center who perhaps are reserving judgment. The midterm elections will matter at this point. If the Democrats win back the House, they'll have control of investigation functions of the various committees. They can begin the process of building on whatever kind of case the Mueller team is able to put together. The Republicans right now are campaigning on the prospect of impeachment if the Democrats take control. So the Republicans have decided to kind of put the Democrats in that position, having taken that position for them, whether it's true or not.
In other words, a lot of Republican candidates, one of their primary campaign planks will be reelect me. I'll vote against impeachment.
Right.
I mean, if you don't want President Trump impeached, vote for me.
Both in terms of voting, but both in terms of fundraising, with donors saying, "Look, if the Democrats take back control of the House, they're going to impeach the president." Again, we don't know that that's what the Democrats would do if they did take back the House, but certainly it seems much more likely if the Democrats take control than if the Republicans hold on to the House. Mm.
Well, of course, we are watching all of this with the most acute sense of interest. And I just have to say, as you were just now talking about what might happen and what might change, the phrase reserve judgment came up. I don't know how many people are reserving judgment these days. We tend to leap to judgment, and the notion of reserving judgment almost sounds quaint.
Well, I mean, especially, I guess, with respect to impeachment, that's worth trying to emphasize.
Right.
There's enough evidence about Mr. Trump's presidency that I think it's very fine for people to have formed solid opinions about his presidency. Is he a capable president? Is he a competent president? Is he doing the things a president ought to do? Is he pushing the kinds of policies that would be good for the country? I think at this point people can make informed judgments about that and should do their best to do so. Whether or not all of this is going to lead to impeachment. Again, I, as somebody who is trying to understand what will happen, I don't know. So any kind of prediction needs to be qualified. Whether what Mr. Trump has done to this point qualifies for impeachment, there I think everybody should reserve judgment until we've really kind of seen the case that's being built. What we know about the case to this point certainly justifies suspicions, but beyond that, I think reserving judgment's not a bad idea.
And on that reassuring note, we finish out yet another interesting conversation with Dr. Jerry Mast, Associate Professor of Political Science at Carthage College. Professor Mast, it's always a great pleasure to speak with you, always illuminating, and I thank you for your time on today's morning show. Thank you so much.
That's good to see you again, Greg.
Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information